here and welcome to the Pack Heavy podcast. Now, this podcast is for anyone who works in the hospitality and food manufacturing industries who use flexible packaging to get their products to market. Featuring interviews with guests who have traveled the path that you're on so that you can learn from their successes and failures and engage in the mindset required to go all in on your vision. I call this mindset the Pack Heavy mentality, and it's primarily driven by deliberate action and extreme organization. You gather market intelligence, put a strong plan in place, organize the appropriate resources, and then confidently test your hypothesis against reality. So if you're ready to pack heavy on your vision, you're in the right place, and I'm excited to have you here. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 14 of the Pack Heavy podcast. Today, I'm honored to have William McKinnon, president of Canadian Alliance, along with us today. William has held senior management positions with some of Canada's largest transport companies, both in the courier and larger freight worlds, along with food service distribution and manufacturers, property security, and with a startup IT company. Prior to his current position at Canadian Alliance, William was the general manager of Western Region for the world's second largest global freight forwarder company, DB Schenker. William is an active mentor at Futurepreneur Canada, guiding startups and entrepreneurs. And in his spare time, you'll find Will both coaching and actively pursuing long distance running. He has raced 18 marathons, including the Boston Marathon in 2005, 11 and 15. Welcome to the show, Will.
Good. Thank you, Ver, for that kind introduction. And since that bio was published, I've actually hit the number of 20. So there we go.
Congratulations.
So milestones, right?
Well, listen, we've got so much that we can talk about. I mean, we can start anywhere, but let's just start in the whole marathon space. Where did you, when did you start? Have you always been an active runner, or is this something that you've taken on in later life?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting story. Sort of in and around 1999, it was sort of on a challenge dare, and I hadn't participated in long distance running. And a friend of mine who had done lots of long distance running, she said, you know, I think we should do a marathon. So I started cold. I started to train. And the next thing I knew in November of 2001, I ran my first marathon in New York. And that was just after 9/11, right? So it was really quite memorable. Mm. I got to tell you, I overtrained. I made all the mistakes that you do, and I'm still learning about how to become a better runner.
Yeah.
But it inspired me to the point where I really liked it. And I sort of, after doing that first race, I went into a little bit of a hiatus and a cocoon. And then since then, I got really serious about my running, and I joined a club in the area that I live in. And I've been with that club now since 2002. Mm-hmm. So we're just in our 19th year and sort of got involved in running and have done in the neighborhood of about 70 races over the last 20 years. Mm. And what I find about long distance running is two things. It attracts people with a certain mindset. It's an endurance sport, so there's a certain psychological side of that. And what I've learned is that endurance athletes typically have a high EQ. It's just proves himself. Is when you're starting to test the boundaries of your body, when you're stressed with fatigue, you got to rely on other resources. So they talk about marathoning as being sort of, how much of it is physical and how much of it is mental. I'd say it's really 80% physical, or pardon me, 80% mental and 20% physical. Anybody can follow the program, you train, and you can adapt and adjust. So what inspires me about it is I like training with athletes and racing with like-minded individuals. And it's been a real thread for my network. And I've built a really strong network of friends today around running that far surpasses the network that I had previous to that. So I feel very blessed to be able to do that.
Is it a daily activity for you, or is it something that you take on, once a week?
Like no. I'm a 4 day a week runner. So I formally train. Given COVID, we've had to sort of change how we train, but I train a small, little pod of individuals, and we train, Monday evening, Wednesday evening, and Saturday morning, and then I run with another group Friday morning. So for me, it's about a 30 to 40 mile a week endeavor. Mm. Or around 50K a week or plus in that area. And we do different types of workouts to stay fit.
That's really interesting. Have you found, running, especially long distance running, so strategic, like you were saying, and it's 80% mental. I believe that for sure. Like the longest run last year, actually, I completed a couple of MEC run races. Nice. They were only short 10K races, but to even get your mindset you know, prepared to run a 10K race and perform on the day, I really found that challenge to be exciting. And how have you found, since you took on long distance running, how has it impacted you and the way that you approach life in general? Like, do you see the way in all things, you know something broad, like know something very specific and you'll see it in all things? Like, does that apply to running and how you approach your daily?
Yeah, I think it does, Hayden. I mean, the key with that is I think what it's done for me is it's given me an appreciation for stamina. And business or your personal life is all about pace. And, you know, I can't, as an endurance athlete, run fast all the time. If you do that, you get injured. You need to train with different types of activities so that when it comes race day, you can really go fast for a longer period of time. So the hallmark for me is that I think it's really helped me to improve my personal stamina and pacing in business and to look at things with the end game in mind. And it's a long game. It's not a short game. Business isn't about a sprint.
Yeah, you're
right. It's about a longer strategic vision. Certainly, we pick up the pace from time to time to achieve certain goals and objectives. But if you're going fast all the time, you burn out. And I have people that I've run into in business say they go fast all the time. Nobody can work 10, 12 hours a day every day of the week. All that happens is you just take 8 hours of work and distribute it over 12 hours. So for me, it's been very strategic and about a mindset.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, recently I've been not suffering burnout at all, but life's extremely busy between, you know, the kids and work and this podcast and learning where I need to incorporate rest into my routine. You know, getting into bed a couple of nights early, a week earlier than usual has been critical to sort of being able to maintain the output of work and the quality of work that I'm looking to achieve right now. Did it take you a long time in life to learn that lesson yourself or, you know, taking on the marathon running and obviously applying that frame of mind into your daily routine as well. Tell us about in your younger days, like when you were taking on your career, did you bite off more than you could chew? And how did you sort of, did you hit a wall?
Yeah, I think what happened is that I think early in your career, you think, you know, speed is all, what it's all about.
Yep.
And I think that I was very fortunate in my career to be promoted to very senior levels at a very early age. And I think the recognition factor was at one point when we had assistants in my early 30s, my assistant came to me who was probably in her 50s. And she said to me, she said, William, she said, your speed scares people. You move very quickly and it disarms people. And it was a really a big wake up call for me because I just thought, you know, that's just the way you got to go. So when I had that feedback, I started to shift from what I saw as my behavior. And I started to look at others more and how I model my behavior and my conduct and my whole pace about how I do things based on people that I respected in business and or in my personal life. And I think that was a conscious shift to do that. Is to say, what are other people doing and what outcomes do they achieve? And how can I influence that? And so really, you know, that continued for many years. And today I still, you know, I look at people that I have been an influence in my career and individuals that I have hold in high regard. And whether they be mentors or influencers, I'm very much aware of that. I look at what people do, I hear what they're saying, but I look at how they convey that message and how they communicate. And I would say I'm today a hybrid model of a whole bunch of different people. I mean, ultimately, I have a personality that's sort of hardened into me, but I've really worked to adapt that to be more universal in nature. I think people go on a path where they get stuck into a certain way and it works for them and that's what they do. But with the changing dynamics that we have today in the environment, with the pressures of COVID and the pandemic of late, with different demographic groups of employees, as well as from different ethnic bases, as well as when they're born, if you just operate the same way all the time, I think it restricts your ability to really tap into individuals' potential.
That is such critical advice. You know, as a leader within, you know, you've been a leader at, like you were suggesting, throughout your whole career, you know, across multiple businesses, and having that emotional intelligence to even recognize that, I think is really special. So you mentioned before that you were lucky and or fortunate enough to have a tap on your shoulder you know, at a young yes. age to sort of give yeah. some advice. When you and I were talking on the phone the other day prior to teeing up this conversation, you mentioned the book Tuesdays with Murray. I actually brought it along yes. with me today. And yeah, that was a book that book. It is. It was a book that I read years ago. And just to give everybody a little bit of context, it's a book about a gentleman. I think he's it's been a while since I've opened it up, but he's a journalist, and he went back and he found his mentor from university. And, yeah. And you said that you were lucky and fortunate enough to find your Murray. Tell us a little yeah. bit about your Murray and, yeah. And the influence that he or she had on your life.
Yeah. My Murray came into my life, I would say about 1989. And it was a gentleman that I met through somebody else who, you know, he was a recruitment consultant. So, you know, his initial connection with me is, how can I help you to hire people?
Yeah.
But what I noticed different about Aaron right at the beginning was that Holocaust survivor, somebody who really had an appreciation for the world and what his position was in life, and somebody who unwaveringly was caring enough to give to others with nothing back in return. And so we embarked on initially a business relationship where he helped me to recruit people. He had a great innate sense of his ability to bring candidates forward that would mesh with what we needed to work with. He relied on handwriting analysis, which he was trained in Austria some years ago, deadly effective in that area. And over the years, I think there's only really one person, maybe he helped me hire 40, 50, 100 people, one failure, right? But what I found with Aaron is that our relationship wasn't about the business. It was about, he truly cared about me. And as I bobbed and weaved through my career, he was always there and very insightful to help me to be responsive and understand what situations best work for me based on the people that I needed to surround myself with, as well as who I was going to work for. And I remember there was a guy that I ended up working for, and Aaron said, I took this position, a very senior position in a publicly traded company, and Aaron said to me, well, send me a copy of his signature, right? And I said, okay, here's the copy of the guy's signature. And he looked at me and he said, this will be dangerous for you, be cautious. And I sort of looked at him and I went, you know, I don't think so. I got to tell you, the guy ended up being a real bear to work for. It was a horrible experience, and he was true to his word. And so what he taught me, though, is initially as I matured, I didn't always take his advice in the same positive way as I do today with others. You know, you become defensive. You know, there's certain things you do. It's like, I don't believe that. And so we developed this wonderful relationship, and most of it happened for us talking about life is that we would get together every couple of months, sometimes on a Saturday, sometimes during the week, and we would have lunch and we would just talk. And he would, regardless of the day it was, he would show up in a suit and tie, ready to go. Never a casual moment for him. And we did this for years, and we talked about a whole bunch of different things. We talked about death and what that meant, and how that affected others and feelings and fears and all those things. And so over a period of about 14 or 15 years, we got to know each other quite closely. And he was a powerhouse of insights and knowledge. And in his early 80s, he got pancreatic cancer, and he was committed to beating pancreatic cancer. And, you know, myself and some others, we did whatever we could to help him. And he went to a clinic in Mexico, and he came back and he had some remission, like a miracle, right? We did that. But, you know, pancreatic cancer is not something that typically you survive and you go into, you get into trouble again. And I remember, you know, I hadn't been with him for several months. He'd been to Mexico, and then we kept saying we'll get together, and he kept delaying. And I said, okay, that's great. And he called me one day and he said, I need a favor. He said, I've got an appointment at the hospital. Can you come and pick me up? I said, great. Sounds good. When do you need me to pick you up, right? And he said, you know, on Tuesday or whatever it was. So I went by his place and I picked him up. And he walked out of the door. There he was, suit and tie as always. And he was yellow. I've never seen anybody that yellow. And I took him to the hospital, explained to me that, you know, that this was jaundice as a result of the pancreatic cancer, but he was confident that he could beat things. And I took him to the hospital, picked him up, brought him home that day. Several weeks later, he ended up in the hospital. And I moved into a routine to visit him with sort of what was going on. And, you know, one day I was driving to work and it wasn't sort of the day I was going to go. And he, all of a sudden, I got this underlying sense that I needed to go to the hospital. And I went to the hospital and I went to his room and his wife was there. And she said, "I'm so glad you've showed up. I think Aaron needs us now." And there was his wife along with a longtime friend. And he was in relatively rough shape, but and I still get chills in my back as I tell the story. He saw me come into the room. He acknowledged that I was there, didn't say very much. And he was sort of laying down. And within about 10 minutes, he raised his arms up over his head. He sat up. He looked at us. He smiled. He went back. And he passed away at that moment, right? And it was such a moving experience because I had never been with anyone when they passed away. But we had always talked about, you know, how death was and how it doesn't need to be like Hollywood portrays it. You know, there's a peacefulness left when, if you believe, your soul leaves your body. And to this day, I thank him so much for that gift. It changed my perspective on life. And much to everyone's surprise, I left the room and I went to the nurse's station and I said, "I just want to say Mr. Prince has passed away." And he said to me, they said, "He has," and they ran in. And, you know, we left the room and then we came back to see him after being sort of through this process where they help you to deal with these things. And what I noticed is that the energy in the room was gone. He'd left us. So, you know, it's important to have mentors. It's important to have people who have followers. And I feel so blessed that he was able to share with me vast influences. And it really has shaped my life, both personally and business-wise, and the things that I've learned and insights to do that. And it's amazing. So, you know, you mentioned the book, you know, Tuesdays with Maury. This is a story about Aaron was my Maury. Pretty amazing.
It's incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that personal story. That's such a touching and moving story. You know, it's not very often that you get to know somebody on such a deep level unless it's family,
yes.
You know, and to have somebody open up to you and obviously you allow yourself to open up to Aaron as well is so special. And to be there right at the end of his life, you know, as well. My dad was a funeral director for years. And obviously was witness to death every single day. And
yes. The
one thing that my dad's taught me, whether you're a religious person or whether you're not, is that death is something that is a part of our lives, obviously. I know that sounds extremely obvious, yes. But it isn't anything to fear. You know, at the end of the day, you could look at our body like a cocoon, you know, and once we've left our body, wherever our soul goes, we don't really know to some degree.
Yes.
But what's left isn't a scary thing. And a lot of people do have a fear around dying. And I think that's something that we all are going to confront at some stage. But when in your life you process that and confront it is completely up to you. And it sounds like you confronted it at a relatively young age. Looking forward, how do you envisage yourself building a relationship, or do you have somebody at the moment that you mentor that you have these conversations with?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's a couple of different things. I've been very much involved in Futurepreneur over the last 8 or 9 years, and I've had the opportunity to mentor young entrepreneurs. And I think what that's given me is some insight into the struggle that people go through to get businesses underway. Mm. And I feel very blessed that I've been able to, you know, share some insights and some observations with others based on many years of experience. By no means do I have it figured out. I'm a work in progress. Life continues on. There's a lot of things going on, but I've really watched a lot of people do things both successfully and unsuccessfully. And I think as an individual, I'm somebody who knows a little about a lot and not a lot about a few things. Mm. So I see myself as a real generalist. And I recognize that the foundation of everything that we have is about relationships and communication. Mm. And anything I can do to help individuals either who report to me today or who I report to or how I have through Futurepreneur, I feel it's important to share those things with them. It's about, you know, giving to others. And, you know, I, as it relates to anything in return, it doesn't matter. The return is in the joy of the gift.
Yeah, it is. Being in these high level positions of leadership across multiple companies as well, I'm sure you're just like everybody else and you had fears and concerns about your own capabilities going into the job. Where were those doubts? Like, you seem extremely confident in yourself now. And I think that has that always been there in you, or is that something that you had to develop?
Yeah, I had to develop it. It's a really good question. I think that early in my career, what my fear was, if you didn't produce the results, you would lose your job, right? And that's sort of how business operates. And so we develop this adaptive personality sometimes based on who we think others want us to be. I think about 20 years ago, the fear of losing a job or the fear of having unemployment, it just left me entirely. So today, I'm not concerned. And I, as you know, in my background, I've sort of changed jobs about every 3 to 5 years because I'm sort of wired that way. I just like that impatience, and I'm a change agent and does that. And I'm not concerned about really as much about tomorrow. I'm concerned about today and being the best person I can be today. And provided I'm responsible, I'm ethical, I operate with honesty and integrity, and I do the best I can with the talents I have, I think I need to do that. So today in business or over the last 20 years, some people would see me as being very direct, sometimes a little bit blunt possibly. And that's, you know, how I may present things. But I just want to be transparent. I don't want to be any confusion about things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you hear about in organizations, political agendas and all that stuff. And I get all that stuff happens. But it's about how you deliver messages and how you process messages. And so today, and for the last 20 years, I focus on what I can do today. We really don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Do you have any structures or frameworks or daily approaches that you take? Do you journal? Do you meditate? How do you get yourself into that frame of mind so that when you're walking through the front doors at work, you are the best possible leader and communicator that you can be?
Yeah, I run. Beyond that, and it's not about anybody chasing me or I'm chasing anyone else. You know, I learned a long time ago that in the morning when you get up and you brush your teeth, you make a decision about who you want to be today. And to be very simple, I just sort of look at the mirror every morning when I'm brushing my teeth and I make a choice about who I want to be. And the choice I need to make about I want to make each day is I want to try and be the best person I can. Oh yeah, there's always the challenges of business and the financial results each quarter and how does that work and did you make budget and all that good stuff. But I really try and put that into context and say, how do I be a good person, right? And so I've learned to really control my emotions more than I did before and try and be on a level playing field. Not that I was a super emotional person before, but you can get wired on the drama of things and really wired up and that's okay. And sometimes I do that on purpose just to create some excitement around things. And I have passion in what I do. And I go to work each day by choice, not out of necessity.
Mm. And how do you assess your life? Do you look at it through the lens of areas that you're falling short and that you need to work on? And how do you go about tightening up in those areas?
Yeah, I think that I'm constantly working on getting feedback.
Yeah,
I say, you know, what do you think? How could I do this better? I think I could do more of that all the time. You know, constantly, you know, we were in a meeting yesterday with the team and we were sort of looking at something we're doing. I said, okay, here's the structure. How can we improve that? This is what we started with. What can we do to make it better versus saying it's discounted or in those areas? And I sense that we have fears of feedback. You know, I was very blessed early in my career and influenced by my dad tremendously, who, you know, was a hardworking individual who, you know, always had a strong value set about honesty and integrity about what we did. And that's just a common thread today. And I always say to my team, I said, you know, we got to do what's right. We don't want to hide behind a veil of legalities or whatever. You got to do what's right for your employees and your customers. And today I juggle the needs of my customers, the needs of our shareholders. And, you know, how do we, in the middle, how do we balance that out?
That's incredibly important, is it? Looking at all the stakeholders. What did your father do when you were growing up? What was his role?
Yeah, my father was a mid-manager for, you know, a communications company. And so I remember my dad, as he navigated through his career, you know, he sort of reached a middle level of management, and that was sort of what he could tolerate. He never moved to senior management. So as I moved to senior management at an early level in my career, he was intrigued by how I was different to achieve those objectives and so those goals and aspirations. And so we talked about that. And I said, Dad, you know, really, I remember you coming home and sharing your frustrations and how things happened. And I remember a situation where the company that he was involved in, there was a large strike. And my dad was one of the managers. And I was like 12 years old at the time. And I was riding my bike down the street and I saw some vehicles for the company that my dad worked for. And I went by there and there was my dad down in the hole as a manager fixing some stuff, because he knew how to do that and managers do that in a big strike. And there were all these unionized workers chanting obscenities at my father, right? Because that's what they did in those days in a blistering situation. And I was 12 at the time. And I remember as a 12-year-old turning to these picketers and yelling at them, how dare you treat my dad that way? Mm. And all my dad did was look at me down in the mud hole and tipped his hard hat to me and smiled. And I left. And I remember when he got home that night at 10 o'clock, he woke me up and he said, thank you for standing up for me. I really appreciate that. And that really influenced me. I it's important to stand up for what you believe in. And it doesn't matter who it is. And I look at that. And so today I do stand up. I think I'm more diplomatic in how I do that. But that was a really important moment as a 12-year-old to see that. And what possessed me? I don't know, but no one's going to mess with my dad.
It's funny, isn't it? You know, kids are very possessive over their parents. And I remember a similar situation with my dad when I was playing cricket and dad was the coach. And I wasn't too impressed with the way that some of the other senior players and leaders within the cricket team were treating my dad either. And I got extremely protective over my dad too. And I see that in my son as well and daughter. She's so young now, but I can imagine that that's an inherent in children's behavior.
Yes.
What do you stand up for now?
Honesty, integrity, yep. Making things right, being a good person. Mm. And I really model those behaviors, I believe, from what I do. And I have tremendous respect. And I've met many people in my career that model those behaviors. You know, I just want to share a short story with you. I remember some years ago in my career, I worked in one of the divisions of McCain Foods when Harrison and Wallace McCain were both running that organization. They've since passed away and it's moved on to the family and all those good things. But I had this very, very fortunate exposure to them early in my career to see two great entrepreneurs who built billions and billions of dollars private company on a global basis. And I remember talking to Harrison at one time at a meeting that we had, and we sort of did a little social thing. And I said, you know, Harrison, and in those days you didn't refer to him as Mr. McCain. Mr. McCain, you know, I'm really curious, you know, what do you attribute your success to? And at that point, you know, it's a $8 or $10 billion company and private and all that good stuff. And he said to me, he said, He said, William, it's really, really three things. He said, my brother and I had a good idea. No question about that. Number two, we surrounded ourselves with the best people we could find to build our vision. And we continue today to treat our employees and our customers very well. He said, it's just that simple. He said, yeah, along the way, there's some bumps in the road and there's a lot of things that we need to do. And we needed to have that risk that we took on that others mightn't have done that. And so I remember in that same conversation, I said, so Harris, you know, you built this enormous company. How do you get inspiration from others? Who do you look to for advice or mentorship? And he said to me, he said, well, William, I got to tell you, he said, there's this professor at the University of McGill named Mintzberg, right? And he said, this guy is really good. He said, I've met him. I've talked to him. I've read his books. And he really has influenced some of the things that I do today. So I listen to what people have. I'm a follower. So got home that day, bought that book, Mintzberg, Essentials of Management. And what Mintzberg really talks about is he talks about what is the role of a manager. And it's really components. There's three major components that you do. It's about, you know, what we call decisional role, an interpersonal role, and, you know, in addition to dissemination of information and the different roles that we take within that. And that really helped me to bring context to my journey as a senior manager. And I've never lost focus with that. Very interesting perspective. And there's more nuances to it. I want to oversimplify Mintzberg's approach to management. But I looked and I go, well, here's somebody who's got an $8 billion company. And they're still looking to mentorship. Extremely important. I think when you stop learning, you die. And I would tell you today, there are some people that are dead that are still walking around.
You know, one thing that I've found, and especially after being introduced to you, like I looked at your LinkedIn page and I looked at your working history and all of the titles that you've held, and I was actually quite nervous to speak to you because I'm like, oh man, this guy is so well accomplished. And yet you're so willing to give advice. And I think that we all put a title up on a pedestal, don't we, to some degree. And I'm really enjoying the fact that I can have this conversation with you today and know that somebody with your title is accessible. You know, like I can actually sit down and have a conversation with you. You also brought up the E-Myth, and I think that this also ties into a lot of what we're talking about right now, in that Michael Gerber, I think it's pronounced Gerber or Gerber, I'm not too sure. Basically, he wrote a book called The E-Myth. Yeah. And basically, I'm just going to read a little bit that I read about it because I have read the book, but it's been quite some time as well. He said the title refers to the belief that entrepreneurs who typically have great or good ideas or come from a technical background actually make poor business people. Now, with the work that you're doing at Futurepreneur, how does that tie in to sort of your approach to sitting down with a new entrepreneur or a startup business? Do you see that in a lot of people that you sit down with? And how do you guide them in the right direction to make right business decisions?
Yeah, I think there's two elements to that. I guess what I see in my mentorship role with mentees is that, you know, it's how do you create replicatable structure around your idea or your concept that permits you to duplicate that business into the future? And a lot of people look at that and they say, okay, just because Sally can make a really good recipe and that Sally has the ability to run a food truck, for example, you're not going to get the financial returns on a food truck business unless you can duplicate or replicate that numerous times over with other people. So it's about structure. You know, when Ray Kroc ran into the McDonald brothers, he didn't see a hamburger joint. He saw an assembly line making burgers that was able to replicate and duplicate quality at a certain level. Whether you like burgers or not remains to be seen. But that's what he saw. And it's sort of like what Henry Ford did. You know, Henry Ford built an assembly line to produce vehicles so that dealt with quality issues, that dealt with, you know, how you get your costs down in all those areas. And so in my exposure in Futurepreneur over the last 10 years, I sort of see two schools of thought on this. I see some entrepreneurs who come in who get this concept and they say, what do I need to do to build structure in my business so that I can stand aside and watch it happen without being hands-on, or others who don't. The ones that don't see the structure, they can still be successful, but they become a slave to their own business. And that's really not what you want to do from an entrepreneurial perspective. Yeah. You want to be able to create that structure so that you can operate in multiple cities, multiple regions, and you could train an army of young kids to run your business like McDonald's does.
Yeah, there's that old saying that everybody knows. You want to allow yourself the opportunity to work on your business rather than in your business.
Absolutely. You know, as you start out, you spend more time in the business, but over time, you want to step aside and you want to be very confident that you can trust the people around you with the right amount of training and structure to deliver what you're going to deliver, those deliverables. Super important.
It's funny, isn't it? You were just telling the story about your dad and him being down in the mud hole and rolling up his sleeves and getting the job done because that was what was required. Have you been put in a position where you've actually had to roll up your sleeves and get the job done because you were either trying to lead by example or it was the right thing to do?
Yeah, I do. I do that all the time. Less today than I did in the past. It just depends what the role you're in and the size and scale of the organization. But there's two things that it does for me. First of all, I like to lead by example. So I think it's important to show people and set expectations. Secondly, I think once in a while, diving deep into the business at a micro level keeps you fresh. You can't be there all the time or you're going to upset your staff. You know, you can't micromanage them. But from time to time, we want to take some deep dives into the business. And I think that that's an important step in how our evolution is. I think back to my career where I've been in some larger organizations and we've had either a public board or we've had a board of entrepreneurs in very large organizations. And from time to time, those individuals will dive into the business. And I really respect for that. Or they say, you know, come and spend a day with me. And they come and spend a day with you to get a perspective of the challenge that they deal with. Ultimately, at the final analysis, it's going to be about producing results and expectations. But, you know, it's important to sometimes walk in other people's shoes a little bit, not all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, especially being in higher management and leadership positions, you may be shielded from the truth or certain elements of the real story getting to you. So going down to ground level and getting the word from the horse's mouth is probably an extremely valuable process.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, what it does is it has a tendency to build relationships and trust. We were talking about this with my management team the other day and how important it is to really, with people that report to you, you know, take 30 minutes a month and really get to know them better. You know, what do they do in their spare time? What does their career look like as it relates to their personal life? What are their hobbies? What are their interests? You know, those are really important things. And it sounds very basic, but it doesn't always happen. You know, I want to work for people that care for me as an individual. I think that's important. That strengthens my relationship and I want to care with them as well. And I think that sometimes we get focused more on the business. And then if you don't spend that time to get to know people, it will certainly impact your ability to build trust.
Is this something that is it like an informal lunch or a coffee, or is it something you catch up in the staff room and just have a great conversation? Or is it something that's a little bit more formalized and structured, like an actual review process?
I think it's structured and I do these, but it's not like a review process. It's more about the person that reports to their time. What do they want to talk and get off their shoulder? I mean, ultimately some of the conversation does evolve. Maybe some granular details within the business. But I try and make that on a monthly basis less about feedback and more about them starting to ask the question, so boss, how do you think I did? You know, how can I get better, right? That's when the trust comes in, right? Versus me saying, well, Carl, this is what I think you should do.
Yeah, got you.
But obviously you go through the quarterly thing and you go the annual reviews, but it, none of those should be surprises.
Yeah, that's the key, isn't it? Like there should be no surprises that come up during those reviews, especially when it comes to somebody's performance as well. Like consistent coaching and, you know, guidance and what would you call it? In a lot of cases, there's Jocko Willink and he calls it commander's intent, you know,
yes.
Coming. Yeah, yeah. So understanding exactly like what that ultimate vision is. How far into the future are you sort of setting goals in business? Is it, and especially because of the fact that you're working for an organization where you do have shareholders and so on, how far into the future are you planning?
Yeah, we plan 5 years into the future. We sort of realistically think we can predict a little bit in the next 3 years. I mean, the pandemic was certainly something that has had some ramifications on things we've needed to adjust in our business that were a surprise as to sort of the behavior of our customers and how supply chain gets changed, surge, you know, this whole world. So we're about 3 years. And then realistically, I think that we can model about 18 months ahead. That's about it.
Yeah, it's tough at the moment, isn't it?
But we do have five-year plan because you want to look at sort of the future and deploy capital, and those things take time to do.
Okay. So can you share a few insights into what you actually do at Canadian Alliance?
Yeah, so I good question. So the team, our organization is really asset-based warehousing logistics company. So we've just recently rationalized four facilities in Metro Vancouver under one roof. So we took four buildings, smaller buildings, into one larger building of 250,000 square feet. And where we add value to our customers really is two sides. We are a strategic stocking location for many global brands. So we help people to get product to market. And we help them from a supply chain perspective, bring goods from the port or from the railhead or from the trucking terminal into our facility. We manage their inventories. And then we help them to get that inventory reassembled to go to the last mile of the delivery. We do a lot of work in the grocery chains. We do a lot of work in the sort of PPE arena today and other market segments, building supplies. So where we add value is on that supply chain. Our focus is where our assets are in our facilities. On our transportation side, we operate in sort of a freight forwarding model where we have strategic alliances with some service partners that permit us to provide those services on a variable basis to our customers and achieve an objective that helps them really. What I want my customers to do is to have, you know, increasing sales because we are able to drive costs out or drive time out or a multitude, drive damages out a multitude in those areas.
Mm. So you just mentioned like global brands coming into Canada. At what point does a shift occur when a small to medium-sized food manufacturer might consider using a 3PL organization like yours?
Yeah, we definitely see that shift. Typically when their sell-through to their customers, say if it's the grocery channel, starts to become large enough that they're supplying multiple stores and they now become, say, with the Overweighty Food Group or the Save-On Food Group or Sobeys or one of those, they become a requirement to supply multiple pallets quickly into DCs. Here's what happens is that, you know, as a manufacturer, say if you're a Canadian manufacturer, you know, you're going to build a certain amount of infrastructure and your core competency may be branding and manufacturing. You know, how much money time do you want to spend on warehousing? You know, you can buy those services on an incremental basis. And what we find is that the large organizations that do this, the large global brands, they typically outsource. To get bigger, they outsource. So they may have 500 containers a year coming in from the Philippines. They are not running warehouses in Toronto and Vancouver. They've got it all outsourced. And the reason they do that is that they see their core business as brand development and manufacturing, or in some cases, it could be totally co-pack manufacturing. And you do that. So I think to get big, you know, when your business starts to grow, you got to give up control in certain areas to know where you're not good at. If you have enough capital and you want to build your own warehousing and distribution center alongside of your manufacturing group, that's great. But do you really want to spend that money on working capital? Do you want to put that into your brand development, into your manufacturing? The best example I can give you is that we handle a lot of specialty food imports. And so those specialty food imports aren't the manufacturer. They may be using a co-packer in southern part of the world. They may be the brand owner because their label is on it. And they decide not to inventory a lot of product in buildings in the country. They rely on a company like Canadian Alliance Terminals to do that. And then they go to market with us on a variable basis. Very common business model.
That's really interesting. And I guess that's your huge amount of expertise is in logistics and supply chain management. What is it about the industry that you love? Like when you got your start in it, what were you attracted to about logistics in particular?
I like the people. And I've always been sort of mystified, less so today than I was, about how things got from where they were to where they are. And that's not going to change. We're not in the position now where we can go with Star Trek and we can move, you know, destruct something and then reposition it across the world and reassemble it virtually, right?
Yeah.
It's about goods to market. And you look at with the pandemic has really increased the awareness of supply chain, particularly where, you know, we had shortages of certain items, right? And, you know, plants weren't able to manufacture and anticipate what was going on. You know, everyone talks now about artificial intelligence and how do we predict the future? You know, what do we need to do to maintain certain inventory storage levels? And I've seen our customers, after they got through the sort of initial stock depletion where March and April, things ran off the shelves really quickly in our inventories. And I've seen them now start to build more inventories as a hedge against what pandemic issues can exist. And then you've seen a supply shortage in capacity, in ocean movement of goods. There's a lot of things going on out there.
Yeah, we've noticed it on our end as well, dealing with manufacturers out of China and so on, where the supply chain and logistics has been it's been a nightmare, to be honest. And both in terms of increase in time and cost. And we've managed to work a way around it in some areas in that we're using air freight to get over small quantities to get our customers up and running with a product. And then the remainder of the stock's coming on over by ocean freight. And that's how we're sort of managing it at the moment. But yeah, I think that being creative in that respect is definitely something that we're all having to do.
Yeah. And also, you know, in our situation, we help customers as they're growing. So customers grow outside of the walls of their building. What do? Can they find a new building quickly? They probably can't. You know, our strategy over time is to have a reoccurring business relationship with that customer. And we just recently concluded one of our existing customers to increase their allocation. Their allocation is quite large today now. They have a monthly allocation of 1,000 pallet positions. It's a lot of inventory. And they have their own facility. But they're at this point, they don't see changing and getting another facility. And they're prepared to contract with us a minimum space of 1,000 pallet positions every month.
It's kind of like thinking of it like you've outgrown your storage space at home in your garage and you need to get some storage. So you go out there and get a storage locker.
you do that. And then sometimes you forget about what's in that locker if it's your own personal goods. What we notice with our customers is that we want to see that product turn. That's important.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Sit around like that.
Fantastic. Well, look, William, we've touched on so much today and I greatly value your time and I know that you're a very busy man. So I don't want to keep you for too much longer, but I do have one more question for you, if that's all right.
Oh, that's absolutely fantastic, Hayden. Thank you.
No worries. So what's next? What's next for William?
You know, in my career, I sort of got some objectives as to what I want to achieve over the next few years. I do have a couple of major things on the way. I've been working on a book. A family storybook about my mom's father, and my mom was born. She's Caucasian, but she was born in Shanghai, and my grandfather had a very interesting life. And I've been doing research on the family for quite a few years. So one of my goals I have is that I want to move to Shanghai for 6 months and really get that book complete. That's really important to me. I want to do that. So I it's hard to do that when I'm working. I need to be there and smell the life in Shanghai. And I've been there a couple of times over the last 7 or 8 years doing research. And so that's a really important thing that I want to do. You know, beyond that, I want to continue to train. I want to stay active in business. And I sort of see my time in business becoming more advisory and less in the business, running a business unit. I have a goal to live to 100. I want to be healthy. I want to be one of those individuals that when I'm 80 years old, I can still do a marathon. And so, yeah, it's all good stuff. Continue to support my family and with my wife and with my son and all my extended family and do that and just, you know, kindle my relationships with my friends. I have a relatively large group of friends, one of which you provided this introduction today.
Fantastic, Will. Like, I love hearing that you're looking to write a book or that you started to write a book. That's a huge undertaking, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, the research, I've got it framed out and I've done most of the research. And I will write the book as if I'm my grandfather. He died when I was 13 years old, but I had this interesting relationship with him. And when he died, I wasn't able to go to the funeral because in those days, your parents don't take your kids to your grandparents' funeral. So my mom placated me with a picture of my grandfather in a uniform. And I had that on my desk for many years and didn't think about it. And then about 20 years ago, I looked at that picture and he was in a uniform and it was a Shanghai Police Department uniform. And I started my research and it led me to a lot of interesting things about my grandfather. Pretty cool individual. I wish someday I get to meet him again because there's a lot of questions I want to ask him about things that I don't know today. But what he did was he laid down tracks for me to follow.
Little breadcrumbs.
No one else knew. I know more about my grandfather's background than my mom and her two sisters ever knew.
That's incredible, isn't it? And this is only something that we've got access to over recent years, you know, with Ancestry.com and all of that. You know, I don't know how we would have gone about doing, is it called genealogy when you're looking back at family history, isn't it? How would on earth would we have been able to do that over the years? I guess it would have been all like newspaper articles and archives and so on, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I found some of that. There's information that I found in London. I connected with an individual in Shanghai who's a professor of history, and he's helped me a lot to do tracks. And we collaborated on a chapter in a book together about the family. So yeah, a lot of cool things. Yeah, he was an interesting guy. He was a effervescent, outgoing individual who had a addiction to gambling.
I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, absolutely. So when he died, he was penniless, but he had a lot of fun along the way.
What was he playing? Was it poker or what was he into?
Oh no, he bet on the horses.
Wow. Okay.
He grew up as a brat at the Singapore Turf Club.
Yeah.
And his family was into horses and horse racing. And he carried that to the day he died. He made a lot of money and he blew a lot of money.
Wow, there are going to be so many lessons that you're going to learn along the way from those stories. That's incredible. Well, listen, I think that we could probably talk about this for another hour, but I know that Absolutely. Your time is valuable, like I said. So look, thank you so very much for your time, William. I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to chat today. And I'm sorry that at times our recording wasn't as clear as I was hoping it would be. But listen, thank you so very much. If there's anybody that wanted to reach out to you and start a conversation with you, what's the best way?
Probably the easiest way to do that is just Google Canadian Alliance Terminals and you will find my contact details on that website. That would be fair enough. Awesome. I think that's easy enough. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Will. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time, Hayden. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Cheers.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions from today's episode or would like to know more about what I can do to help you achieve your packaging vision, you can reach me directly at hayden@thepackheavypodcast.com. You could DM me on Instagram @thepackheavypodcast, or we could also connect on LinkedIn and start a conversation there. I'll see you next week.